Peggy again.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Stacey Hagee, and again, I'm here on behalf of the appellants in this matter. The state contractor's excise tax on the non-Indian contractor is not preempted because, as recognized by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act does not comprehensively regulate construction contractors. Additionally, the Flanger Santee Sioux Tribe has failed to show that the remaining federal and tribal interests justify preemption of the state tax here. Now, this construction project at issue includes $24 million expansion and renovation of the casino and its ancillary businesses, such as a hotel, restaurant, bar, administration building, VIP lounge, and casino floor. The tribe entered into a contract with an out-of-town contractor to perform these construction services and agreed to pay the contractor for all legally imposed taxes. The legal incidence of the contractor's excise tax is on the contractor, and essentially there are no exemptions. That means for construction work done on an Indian reservation for the federal government, the contractor in that case is still subject to the contractor's excise tax.
Now, there's a reference in the brief to an exemption from the contractor excise tax for work on the tribe, which apparently is a tie-in of other federal regulations that I'm not familiar with. Just explain, what are the other federal regulations? And what do they permit and so forth?
So the
NEPRA didn't exist, and this contractor wanted that exemption. What would have to be shown, and what would the remedy be for if it was denied?
So the state looks at if a contractor is doing work for an Indian tribe on the reservation, they submit an Indian country request for exemption. In that case, the state under Bracker looks at each of these under a case-by-case basis to determine, for instance, whether there's comprehensive and federal regulation of the taxed activity. The department has made the determination that this exists regarding tribal hospitals, tribal housing projects, and tribal schools under the Rama case. If there's...
So this is the state, an exclusively state-administered exemption applying Bracker principles and looking at whether the federal gaming regulators would consider it. So it's not really, is it a federal regulated, is the exemption driven by federal regulation, or is it the way the state administers its tax?
It is driven by the federal regulation, Your Honor. While we call,
where in the federal regs would the state be required to grant an exemption?
We believe we have to look to Bracker if the.
But Bracker is judicial. I mean, are there BIA or DOI regulations that address this issue?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor.
Okay, so this is a state applying federal judicial law.
Correct, Your Honor. And while the state calls it an exemption, it's not really an exemption under state law. It's the state trying to make a system to apply the federal law.
And you look at federal regulations that govern the subject of the tax to see whether there is a comprehensive scheme, for example, that would lead you to think that Bracker requires this quote-unquote exemption. Is that what you're saying?
Correct, Your Honor. And in addition to the comprehensive and pervasive federal regulation, the state would also look to whether there's tribal interests involved. And in that instance, the state has in the past exempted tribal government buildings because the state views those as buildings that affect the tribal's right to govern itself and make their laws and be ruled by them.
Does the state do any written opinion when it makes this determination, or is it just a yes or no conclusion?
It's a yes or no conclusion, Your Honor.
It's the only time you explain it is in litigation like this, apparently. There's no opinion letter, for example, from...
No, Your Honor.
Official. All right.
No, Your Honor. As in Gerlach, the first question is whether IGRA preempts this tax outright. If IGRA does not preempt the tax, then we look to whether Bracker preempts the tax. Here, again, neither justify preemption. The lower court ruled that IGRA preempts the state tax on the contractor because IGRA comprehensively regulates Indian gaming and there's no room for the state tax. But IGRA, again, is only aimed at the gaming. It is not comprehensive regulation of the construction of the casino buildings, structures, hotels, and restaurants. Again, keep in mind the specific transaction the state is taxing, the contractor's construction services.
Does it matter what they're constructing based on the discussion you've had about the way the state applies the exemption? It seems like, in theory, you could have a different answer if they were just constructing the casino where the gaming is versus other buildings. Is that a distinction that the state would make, do you think?
Not in the context of the casino here, because the IGRA does not regulate that activity. Now, that does come into play, in the topics I mentioned, such as a school where there's a regulation of the actual contractor's work.
So this, and remind me, this construction was of the, you said, the casino floor, but also other amenities. So it's sort of a conglomeration. What if they'd carved out just the casino floor part? Is that a stronger argument for the exemption then, given the examples? And it's just the amenities that are added into the construction plan?
I don't think it's a stronger argument by any means, because we still have to look at the federal regulations of that activity, and here there is none. The lower court's decision actually highlights this. It's actually evident through the lower court's decision, because as cited by the lower court, IGRA requires that the tribe enact an ordinance regarding constructing and the construction and maintenance of the facility, that it's done in a manner that adequately protects the public. If work is going on in a casino, it's the tribe that has to protect its patrons from that ongoing construction. Also, while there's federal regulations, those federal regulations require the tribe to submit a facility license. Neither of these actually impose any regulations or restrictions on the contractor or its work. Those are aimed at the tribe.
Has there been any litigation? I'm back to this federal regulation. It sounds to me like the contractor here could have sued for the denial of an exemption, either state court or federal court, conceivably tribal court, and didn't do so.
The contractor has a remedy through the state administrative process and through the state circuit court and state supreme court.
And where would the Bracker decision be made, be reviewed? Not probably by an administrative hearing officer. They usually say, I can't get into constitutional issues.
The state circuit court could take that issue up.
Has there been any litigation of that kind?
No, the tribe did not pursue a hearing the contractor did not request a hearing on the denial or pursue that.
Has any contractor ever taken the denial of this exemption to court?
Not to my knowledge.
If it's the Bracker analysis that applies, then the U.S. Supreme Court would have certiorari jurisdiction over a state court decision denying the exemption. So there looks to me like there's an exhaustion of remedies problem here.
Yes, there.
I mean, the tribe jumps in and sues when you say that, and I think the tribe admits the incidence is on the contractor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Contractor pursued remedies, and then rather than pursue them to the U.S. Supreme Court, the tribe jumped into federal district court. Is that a fair description?
That is fair description. The contractor has never brought suit in this instance.
Well, actually, that suit could raise IGRA as well as Bracker, since everybody agrees that they're sort of side-by-side issues, neither subsumes or consumes the other.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Presumably, this IGRA challenge could have been raised by the contractor.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Okay. Here again, Yee highlights that IGRA is a gambling regulation statute, not a code governing construction contractors. In Bracker, you had you had regulations imposed on the taxpayer. In that case, you had federal regulations such as the taxpayer was required to repair, maintain, and build roads. There were load restrictions imposed on the taxpayer and mandatory contract terms on the taxpayer. The same is in RAMA. There, the federal regulations were imposed on the taxpayer. The federal regulations included wage requirements on the contractor and contract requirements on the contractor. Now, there is a type of contract that IGRA extensively regulates, management compacts, management contracts. But the tribe has not contended that this is a management contract. Next, the contractor's work does not fall in the scope of the tribal governance of gaming. This case is similar to Ledyard, where a vendor's ownership of a slot machine located in a tribal casino did not qualify as gaming, and taxing that slot machine did not interfere with the tribe's governance of gaming. You can also consider IGRA in a criminal context. IGRA covers crimes related to gaming. It doesn't cover all crimes just because they occurred in a casino. Now, steered by the Gerlach Court's incorrect analysis of the catch-all provision, the lower court here ruled that the construction and renovation of the casino and ancillary businesses fell within the catch-all provision. Again, as in the earlier argument today, the lower court's broad interpretation of the catch-all provision must be rejected because it extends the catch-all provision past this court's recognized scope of IGRA, which is the tribal governance of gaming. This overextension is especially evident in the contractor's work on the ancillary businesses. Under Section 9.2 of the compact, 21-year-old, those under 21 are not allowed on the premises where gaming is conducted. Yet here in this case, there is no assertion that individuals can't be in the hotel or restaurant, the ancillary businesses here. Thus, these businesses can't be considered premises where the gaming is conducted. Again, the but-for test. The court held that the but-for test applied and that but for the casino, the project would not exist. And conversely, but for the project, the casino could not operate. For reasons articulated in the Gerlach oral argument, the lower court erred in applying this test. It would also require the state to determine that at what point the construction is necessary or unnecessary for a casino to continue operating. This goes against the Supreme Court's principle noted in Chickasaw, which is that tax administration requires predictability. Now, as to Bracker, the court primarily relied upon a general federal and tribal interest in tribal economic development. But this, again, conflicts with the unappealed portion of the Gerlach decision that tribal sovereignty and tribal economic development are insufficient to bar the state tax. Here, the contractor does not have a say in tribal affairs or share in any of the tribal disbursements.
But this is, this enterprise is one of the key revenue spots for the tribe, right? So it is the focus of what the tribal sovereignty is all about, right?
That could be said for any tribal venture by a tribal government.
So you don't think that it's that the fact that it's the casino and it's the casino operation and it is the key source of revenue, that sets it in any way apart or different from another type of revenue generating business?
No, Your Honor, I do not believe it sets it apart. Here, this is, again, the tax on the contractor. And it's comparable to Cotton Petroleum, which stated that through the enactment of certain federal legislation, Congress sought to provide tribes with a profitable source of revenue. But there's no evidence for further supposition that Congress intended to remove all barriers to profit maximization. The same can be said about IGRA. The lower court seemed to require some sort of tax manipulation to occur in order for the state to retain its taxation jurisdiction over non-members. This is not supported by Yee. Yee does not state that without the rigging of a tax exemption, the federal interest in a tribe's economic vitality would defeat an otherwise legitimate state tax. It used the tax manipulation to further diminish the federal and tribal interests that were already diminished, not to justify preemption on its own. Plus, placing a requirement of tax manipulation would again go against the Supreme Court statement in Chickasaw that tax administration requires predictability. States have to be able to administer their state tax on non-Indian contractors. Regarding the state's interest in the Bracker balancing test, the lower court erred in discounting the state services because of a lack of nexus between the contractor and the state services.
And weren't those state services just general state services that were not necessarily linked to this activity?
And I believe that's where the lower court went in saying that there was not that link. But this nexus requirement conflicts with the lower court or the Gerlach court's unappealed decision, which did not require that nexus. In that case, the Gerlach court recognized that South Dakota residents generally benefit from the state services and noted that the relevant services under a Bracker analysis include both services on and off reservation. This is especially appropriate given the contractor's shop in this case is located in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, which is approximately 35 miles away from the project site. State services provided to employees as they travel between the shop and the project site are certainly appropriate to consider here. It is not necessary to quantify the services actually provided. Requiring a quantification would be inappropriate, as it would fail to recognize that tomorrow a contractor and its employees could use these services. Tomorrow, an employee could sue the contractor in state court for not paying him the wages from this construction project. Tomorrow, an employee could get hurt at this project and use ambulance services and emergency technicians and go to an off-reservation healthcare facility, all of which utilize state general funds to which this tax goes into. The legal incidence of this tax is on the contractor. The lower court's decision conflicts with Yee that construction contractors fall outside of IGRA's preemptive scope. If you have no further questions, I would reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Mr. Pearman?
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Seth Pearman, and I represent the Flandreau Santee Sioux Tribe in this matter. The purpose of the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act is to provide a statutory basis for the operation of gaming by Indian tribes as a means of promoting tribal economic development, self-sufficiency, and strong tribal governments. And in doing so, ensures that the Indian tribe is the primary beneficiary of the gaming operation. This is enumerated in legislative history of the Act, and in the actual language of IGRA itself. The state attempted imposition of contractors' excise tax in this matter is preempted by IGRA, and allowing such imposition frustrates the intent of IGRA's passage and causes harm to the tribe. There are two barriers that stand in the way of the state exercising its taxing authority on the non-Indian contractor in this situation, and the first being preemption, and the second is whether or not the infringe on the right of the reservation Indians to make their laws and to be ruled by them.
Why aren't there standing and exhaustion problems here?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Why aren't there standing and exhaustion problems here when the contractor had an available remedy to raise all these federal issues?
In this instance, the tribe, after it was denied the certification, it exercised its authority under its rights under Ex Parte Young and went straight to the federal courts to have this matter resolved. And in Dorsey and Whitney, it determined...
What is the standing?
The standing for the tribe?
It's an indirect revenue impact. Why the tribe was not a party to the tax... It was indirectly a party because it agreed to pick up the tab. Even if that gives the tribe standing, why isn't exhaustion of the tax exemption process required?
Your Honor, in this situation, we believe that both could have happened. If we go and look at Rama, which is a very controlling case in this matter, in that instance, it was the school board who actually brought the case against the state. And in that instance, the school board was fighting a contractor's excise tax on grocery receipts on the construction of that project. And in doing so, they determined, the court, that there was an entirely federally preemptive scope because of the Indian Self-Determination and Education Act, and therefore the state was unable to impose its tax because it did have a direct economic burden on the tribe and would impact the overall programming of that school. This is the same situation here. Whether or not the state imposes the legal incidence on the contractor to collect that tax and remit it, the court, in our case, found that that economic burden falls directly on the tribe. And in doing so, it has a couple of different instances where it directly benefits us. The first is that the project itself has less money to operate, and the scope of the project was therefore diminished. And secondly, anything remaining, and again, the tribe uses these excess funds to actually fund if it was $450,000 representing 2% of the overall tax, that's about 2% of the overall tribal budget. And if it's unable to do that, it's a large impact on its programming that it offers to tribal members and the community. Again, when we look at the overall scope of IGRA itself, it is incredibly preemptive. And in Dorsey and Whitney, this circuit held that to be true. In that to further that principle, because we have to take a step back and look at exactly why IGRA was passed in the certain circumstance that it was. In this instance, Congress looked at the three governmental bodies and determined exactly what roles and responsibilities each should have. And in California versus Cabazon, that came out right before IGRA, the Supreme Court determined that the state should have no impact or no role in the operation of gaming on the Indian reservation. So Congress at that point took a look at that ruling and set aside certain responsibilities for each of the parties. Conferred the only authority under the state in the instance to be within the compacting process. It reserves some of the responsibilities itself, and everything else is delegated to the tribe.
Was there any hint in Carbazon that the court was addressing state taxation of non-member activity?
Not expressly, Your Honor. But again,
why would it be implied?
It could be implied because it says that the entire field was preempted, and this. That the Indian.
I thought it was more that the states can't tax tribes, including tribal gaming.
Well, it determined in that case that the state's regulatory scheme in California would not have any or could not have an impact on the operation of gaming for the Cabazon tribe. Again, if we go beyond just the general overall scope of IGRA, we find certain instances within the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act itself that specifically deal with construction and the maintenance of facilities. The building standards found in 25 U.S.C. 2710B2E regulates the operation of Class 2 gaming, and it says specifically that the chairman, that meaning the chairman of the NIGC and not the chairman of the tribe, must approve a tribal resolution that provides for the construction and maintenance of gaming facility and the operation of that gaming, and to ensure that the operation of that gaming is conducted in a manner which adequately protects the environment and the public health and safety. This again, in our...
But not the revenues.
Nope, that would be a different portion of the statute that actually determines what revenues can be used for. If you look at IGRA as a whole, as it pertains to revenue, every bit of revenue that comes out of a casino is regulated. So, for instance, if the tribe were to handle, the state brought up a management contract, it states that if money from the casino operation is going to another party and they control an overall interest in the operation of that facility, that only a certain amount can be handled and that the NIGC must approve that contract.
The NIGC comprehensively regulates what the tribe does with the profits?
It does. There are five sections.
So the tribes that support other tribes in a pro bono type manner and those that don't, the NIGC signs off on every decision?
It signs off on exactly what it can be spent for, Your Honor, not every decision. For instance, it could be spent on local government, so the tribe could elect to give the local government a portion of its funding. It could be spent on economic development interests of the tribe. It can be spent on government operations. It can go to tribal members in the event that a revenue allocation plan is approved by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And again, those are, again, show the concept that every bit of money that's coming out of that facility must be regulated. In addition to that, the tribe is required to file an annual audit with the NIGC, which provides that an outside contractor, audit firm, must come in and make sure that all of the books are in compliance with the actual financial statements. And that is, again, another instance in which the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act and the federal government make sure that every bit of money is accounted for and used in accordance with the act itself. To continue, although this, the first section that I read regarding the maintenance standards of Class 2 operations are specific to that section, if you go a bit further in the Act itself, in 2710 D1A2, it clarifies that these same standards must apply to Class 3 facilities as well. So again, being that the Royal River Casino is a Class 3 facility, we would say that these same standards are applicable there. If you then jump into the actual federal, or the further licensing requirements of the federal government itself, in 25 CFR Part 559, entitled Facility License Notifications and Submissions, the tribe itself must also then certify through its gaming commission that the facility meets the safety requirements of the acts that we discussed, or excuse me, of the sections that we discussed above. The NIGC then reserves the right to inspect the property at any time. And within that statute, if the tribe fails to meet those maintenance and safety precautions and building standards, then the NIGC has the ability to fine the casino and to shut it down. So again, because this activity is delegated to the tribe, it is preempted by the attempted imposition of standards by the state is preempted. Except in the event that they were to utilize the state and tribal compact to institute some building or safety standards, which is an approved, one of the seven approved areas in which a tribe and the state can compact.
Which of the seven applies here?
So we believe that subsection 6 would be the one that is most on point in this situation, and that provides specifically that for the standards of operation of such activity and maintenance of the gaming facility. So in the event that the state believed that the tribe should follow the most up-to-date building code, universal building code, if there was a specific situation that needed to be addressed that hadn't been before, that is a matter that could have been brought up in the compact process. To go further, the subsection 7 of that same section also states that any other subject that are directly related to the operation of gaming activities and is often referred to as the catch-all provision. So the catch-all provision, the test to determine, like we discussed before, to determine whether the activity is related to gaming, comes out of Coyote Valley 2. And that's the, but for the tribe's gaming activities, the construction project would not exist, and it would have to show that the tribe could not operate its gaming activities without the construction or renovation. So in this instance, the court delved right into the overall structure of that but-for test and finding that there wasn't another test that was what was applicable to the situation. They adopted that standard. And they said the first part of that test is clear. If no casino existed, then there would not be a need to renovate it. That's pretty straightforward in the facts. And the court believed that the second was a bit more nuanced, and stated, did the tribe need to do the renovation project? And in this instance, the tribe's position and the court found that it had to do this project. Would we go back to the overall intent of IGRA? It was to provide for a safe environment for the tribe and for patrons to gamble in accordance with the act. In this situation, the tribe depends on 40%, or the casino is 40% of the tribe's overall annual budget, which is a large percentage of that, and it again takes those programmings, those bare-bone federal programmings, to make them fully functional and operational within our jurisdiction. This also funds various programming and salaries throughout the entire tribe itself, and it would leave us in a real pinch if we were unable to use those gaming revenues to actually facilitate our government operations. Secondarily, when it looks at the actual...
2%, yeah, 2% of this contractor's role in the renovation somehow puts the tribe at risk financially? It seems to me there's a lot of hyperbole flying around here.
It does have a direct economic impact on the project and the tribe itself. Not only was this project...
So does the other 98% of what they're paying the contractor.
Absolutely.
All in order to increase revenues and profits down the road, or else they've made a bad decision.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And in doing so, the tribe definitely assessed whether or not it needed to. The tribe's executive committee, being the governing body, determined whether or not that project must happen. And again, when we look at whether or not...
Anything in the record that if the contractor hadn't... If he didn't get the exemption, they'd back off the project? No.
Not the project as a whole, and again...
They contemplate... I'm sure they made the decision contemplating that this 2% may be at risk or in play.
Yes, and at that point, the executive committee determined that it would contest those overall, the imposition of those taxes, and in doing so, would continue to meet the objectives of the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act to provide for those standards of maintenance and safety. This property was built in 1997 and has not had a substantial renovation. Its mechanical systems are failing. Its parking lot needs to be replaced. There are various things that a new roof had to be put in. In that instance, it was a requirement that the tribe do this. So in the event that something catastrophic would happen, it wouldn't force closure or fining. And again, the 40% that I was bringing up was just to indicate how important the casino's finances to the tribe are in the overall scheme of the tribal operation. So again, the court went further and said that, again, without this construction project, the tribe would be unable to operate its facility within the scope and the requirements of the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act. If we go even further and then look at the second test, the court... Excuse me, let me back up just a second. In Dorsey and Whitney, it stated that if the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, if the court found that it was preemptive of the matter, that there was no need to balance. But in this instance, Judge Schreier did go into the actual second step of Bracker announcements to determine whether or not this state activity infringed on the operation or on the ability of the tribe to make their own laws and to be ruled by them. And the court, when balancing the interests of the state, the federal government, and the tribe, looked at a variety of issues to determine whether or not the certain exercise of state authority would violate this law. And it determined that when, again, looking at some of the services and other things that are actually provided to the project, that the state's interest was and burden in showing that it actually was providing and deserved this tax had not been met. State jurisdiction, again, if we look back at the best example, I think, in this instance is City of Duluth versus Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Indians. And in that instance, the city was imposing a rent or a lease payment on the operation of the facility by the Fond du Lac Band. And it determined that because that amount was so much higher than the actual benefit that the tribe was receiving, that the tribe or that the state would not be able to impose that. I think it was $6 million. And the operation itself was generating a number far less than that. So it was actually impeding the operation of gaming and had changed the benefit from the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act of the tribe being the sole proprietary interest to then benefiting the state for an obvious person that's outside of the overall scope. Again, if we go back to another case in the Eighth Circuit and we look at the Marty Indian School case, in that instance, the state was attempting to impose a fuel tax on the school. On the school's use of vehicles in that situation. Again, the court in the Eighth Circuit took a look at RAMA itself, determined that the scope of the Indian Self-Determination and Education Act was preemptive in this field, and as it pertained to the second part, that the state services that were being provided to the overall project were not persuasive. They stated that they gave a few roads and things like that, and again, the state made the same argument in this case, that by providing roads to the project, again, it would benefit the tribe. Those roads were not built to benefit this project. Those roads were built to benefit the general population of the state. And again, the lower court determined that that was not a persuasive argument. The other instances within the contractor's excise tax itself that the state that I'd like to bring up is that first, the contractor's excise tax is a tax on gross receipts. The project's location is where the state, or is exactly where the state says the tax is imposed. The project location is on, in Indian Country at our gaming facility. That is an undisputed fact. When we go even further, it states that the collected revenue from that matter goes to the general fund. And then it's, the state further says that some of the services that it provides to the project generated from the are not generated from the general fund itself. So when they talk about licensing of engineers, lawyers, things like that, the lower court found that unpersuasive in that all of those, all of the licensing requirements of those positions were generally applicable to all professions or to those professions across the state. And most of those have a fee associated with them. Secondarily, when it pertains to all of the regulation of this project, the tribe is bearing the cost of the project itself and is paying people to come in and Geotech, for instance, is testing the geotechnical standards for the materials used in the project. It has HDR, secondary engineering company, come in and review payment applications. Its architect has been tasked with reviewing construction as it goes. And the tribe even goes further to actually provide surveillance, security, storage, and a few other things that actually benefit the project far beyond any of the small or minuscule things that the state portrays. The states, even when they, for instance, the licensing of electrical engineers, when a permit is pulled in that instance, an inspection is done. The tribe pays for that inspection. Even if it doesn't pay for it directly, that comes through a payment application, which is absolutely borne by the tribe. One other thing that I'd like to address is that in this instance, the state said that this is a non-Indian contractor, we agree, and that the contract documents state that if the contractor is able to utilize its shop to construct some of the projects or what it can do, it should. That's a standard AIA form document that is intended to benefit the overall project by being more efficient. In this instance, this is a renovation of an existing facility. Everything in the record indicates this. All of the activities related to construction are done on the reservation at the property. You can't renovate a building by building things within the shop itself. Again, I see that my time is expiring. I thank you all for your time today, and I would stand by for any questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Rebuttal, Ms. Heggie?
The tribe says you can't renovate the building without being there, but you also can't renovate the building without driving from Sioux Falls, in this instance, to the construction project. Now, the tribe wants you to look at the economic incidence of the tax, but the 10th Circuit in Seminole Tribe versus Strandberg warned against treating economically inevitable pass-throughs the same as a legally mandatory pass-through. The court highlighted the Supreme Court's ruling in Chickasaw Nation, which insisted on mandatory legal requirements over economic realities, no matter how automatic those realities may be. That's found at page 1350. There's nothing in Cabazon regarding the state's taxation of non-members. Cabazon related to the state's trying to impose gambling regulations on a tribe. IGRA addressed that scenario. Absent from the tribe's argument are federal regulations that are imposed on the contractor, and such that would leave no room for the state tax on the contractor. The tribe also points to the City of Duluth case. In that case, there was $75 million in payments going from the tribe to the city. And also in that case, it was an issue of whether the tribe had a sole proprietary interest in the gaming. That case is not what we have here. We're not talking about $75 million in payments to the state. The tribe also talked about Marty. But in that case, the state was trying to impose a tax on the tribe. That tax is categorically preempted regardless of any Bracker analysis. Absent congressional authorization, the state could not have imposed that tax. Now, IGRA preempts a state tax on the gaming proceeds. IGRA does not preempt a tax on the construction project here. What's more concerning is that there's the tribe's open-ended position that anything that would deflate its revenues is preempted. Interpreting the catch-all provision broadly, again, to preempt state jurisdiction over the non-tribal member contractor in this case would again permit the state to increase its jurisdiction over tribes through the compacting process. The state respectfully requests the lower court's decision be reversed. If there's no further questions, I will sit.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Once again, the case has been very well argued and thoroughly briefed. Important. We'll take it under advisement. Please call the last case for argument.
The fifth and final case today is 18-1086, District of Minnesota, the Midwest Disability Initiative et al. v. Jans Enterprises et al.